It's summer in the Mississippi Delta, and three siblings have been warned to stay away from the old rock quarry called the Devil's Place. But one hot August day, the older two are banished from the house along with their six-year-old sister. They head over to the forbidden quarry to swim. By day's end, Pansy, the little sister, is gone, and the older two are left with only questions. Why did they leave Pansy alone while they picked berries? And what did 14-year-old Bert see in the woods? Bert is convinced that her missing father took the little sister. Snippets of the South's horrifying history and the father's hidden past surface in alternating chapters. Then the mother dies of heartbreak. The years pass, and Bert and her brother begin a journey to find the truth. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host of New Books in Literature for the New Books Network, and I'm talking to Tiffany Quay Tyson. Today we're discussing her new novel, The Past Is Never, a 2018 Okra pick of the Southern Independent Booksellers Alliance.
Hi, Tiffany, and thank you for joining me on this New Books podcast.
Hi, Galit. I'm super happy to be here.
So let's start with you telling us how you came to write this beautiful story.
Well, first of all, thank you for calling it beautiful. And, you know, after my first book came out, or actually I should say before my first book came out, I had started trying to think about what I wanted to write next and what I wanted to explore. I started out with the idea of exploring memory and kind of the way that if two people witness the same incident or experience the same incident, they will in fact remember it in very different ways. And as I started thinking about that, and I was writing all these little, I write in a very nonlinear way. I tend to write scenes and snippets, and then I kind of figure out how things go together, particularly when I'm first starting a novel. And as I was playing around with that idea of the sort of slipperiness of memory and the way that our experiences make us all come to our experiences in a different way, I got to this point where I was writing about these siblings, and I thought, you know, that's a good point to start, because siblings experience so many things together, but they're different ages, and they come to the world with different perceptions, even though they've been raised kind of in the same way. So I wrote that scene. I wrote a scene that's one of the first scenes in the novel where these three siblings go out to a quarry that is forbidden. And that's what sort of sets off the entire novel. And as I was writing, my idea about memory sort of started to shift and change. And I started exploring the idea of the stories that we tell in our families. I am particularly interested in the way stories evolve and change through the generations. And I don't know if you've had this experience, but I've certainly had this experience. When you're growing up and your parents tell you a story when you're very young, they tell you a certain version of a story that might have something to do with your family, with your grandparents or with them, maybe how they met. And then as you get a little bit older, that story begins to evolve and change. And then as you get older still, that story might be completely different than the one they told you as a child. I mean, as an example, you know, this is the story of how we met. And we, you know, went on a date together at a restaurant. And then later on, it's like, oh, no, we met at a bar. And then later you might discover, you know, something even more, a little more verboten. And so I like the idea of exploring how these stories that we tell one another kind of evolve and change and shift, not only as people get older, but as the generations pass. And that ultimately is what drove me writing the story, was the idea of talking about storytelling.
So we have a lot to talk about. First of all, when this happens and the kids run to swim in the quarry on this very hot day.
Yeah.
It turns out that their father is away a lot of the time. And so they're not surprised that he's been gone for over 3 weeks when the little sister disappears. What can you tell us about their father and the schemes that he is involved in with Uncle Chester?
Well, the father is not exactly a stand-up guy when it comes to his employment. He really never considers going out and looking for a traditional job or, filing for Social Security. I mean, he really lives kind of outside of the margins. He had an interesting and sort of rough upbringing, and he has basically learned how to make a living by counterfeiting money at this point. He's had other schemes in the past, but this is what he's doing now. And he and Uncle Chester have been basically washing bills and reprinting them as larger bills, which is a thing that counterfeiters actually do. And then they launder that money. So they basically go out and spend it all over the South and then either return things to get good money back, or in some cases they can sell the bills to people who are kind of down on their luck and who need, you know, who might have $5, but they don't have 50. And so they're trying to get a little something for nothing, I guess.
Well, this takes place, was it in the 80s?
It starts in 1976.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. So at that time, that was more possible. Now it might not be as easy to do.
Correct. Correct. It would be a little bit harder. Although ultimately, if someone is counterfeiting, this is the best way to do it and not get caught, at least at the source of, you know, at the store or wherever you're actually spending cash. Of course, people spend a lot less cash nowadays.
Right. Right. So there's such an interesting dichotomy between mythology and mm-hmm. history. So that you share a lot of history, but you also share a lot of stories based on different kinds of myths. Could you talk about that?
Absolutely. And that's part of what I mean when I say that it's sort of a story about storytelling. There are these threads, and that's what you're kind of alluding to here, that go through, that talk about the past, particularly the past surrounding this quarry that they were not supposed to go swim in, but other places as well, and other family lore as well. And one of the things that I find fascinating and have always found fascinating is the idea that a particular place carries memories or carries a curse. That's what I worked with here, was the idea that that a place could be cursed. In Mississippi, which is where I grew up and where much of the story is set, there are a number of places like this. I think it's probably true everywhere because that's where I grew up. I'm familiar with those places. There's a place in Natchez, Mississippi called the Devil's Punch Bowl. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but it's basically a huge depression on the Mississippi River. It's just a big old, cavernous depression. There are a lot of wild peach trees growing around this depression. Just after the Civil War, and actually probably at the end of the Civil War, it was a concentration camp where freed slaves were forced into labor. People didn't like the idea that they were free. They captured them. And many were Union soldiers who did this. They captured them, marched them in there, put them into, put them back into slavery. And thousands, tens of thousands of those slaves, freed slaves, died in that particular depression. And so to this day, people are pretty sure that it's haunted. Even now, when it floods, the bones will come up. And the one other thing that this particular place is known for is its prolific wild peach trees. But the locals don't eat the fruit because they know that the land is fertilized by the bodies of these slaves. So it's both terrible and fascinating at the same time to me that, you know, something that happened more than 150 years ago can continue to have an effect on the residents and the people who live and who, you know, exist in this area. So I'm fascinated by the idea of that. And there are a number of stories like this. You know, there's the idea that of the blues musician Robert Johnson, who went to the crossroads and sold his soul to the devil. And that actually happened, you know, through lore, that happened pretty close to where I have set my Mississippi Delta town. And so there's this long and storied history in Mississippi and in other places in the South, where there are these sort of folkloric mythological tales that are actually based in something that happened. And people are still responding to things that happened 100 years ago or 200 years ago. And I'm fascinated by that.
Mm. So the Devil's Plate, or rock quarry in the book, is that based on the devil, the place that you were just discussing? Or is this a new...
It's not in the same geographical location, so it is not the same place. And it,
but based on it?
But, you know, some of the mythology is based on it.
Mm. So Bert is telling the story when she's a teenager, and she says that Pansy was strange and different from birth.
Right.
With a large purple birthmark on her thigh, and she was beautiful, and the most important thing was that she was their mother's favorite child.
Mm-hmm.
What can you talk about?
Well, you know, I like the idea of exploring. I started out to explore the sibling relationships. And once I started kind of going down that path, and I felt like I had Bert pretty well set in my mind. I knew who Bert was, and Bert was an ordinary girl, but an ordinary girl with a good deal of spunk and curiosity, and someone who was not going to be easily deterred as she went out and tried to solve the mysteries of her family, which she does. And I felt like I had Willett pretty well settled in my mind. Willett's an ordinary boy. He's an ordinary boy doing the best he can, and he'll step in and help anyone. But Pansy, as the younger child, I wanted to set her apart somehow, because she does go missing very early in the book, and they are searching for her. And when I'm thinking about those sibling relationships, I mean, one thing that's great about sibling relationships is that sometimes the siblings are close and they're great friends, but quite often it's deeper and more complicated than that. And the siblings, there's some level of resentment or competition. And so with Pansy, I was kind of playing with that. And then of course, there is some information about Pansy that comes out later in the book that I won't reveal here, that makes her different, that makes her differentness, her otherness, make more sense, I think, to the reader. And to Bert, it reveals why she was treated differently, why she was raised differently in the time that she was raised with them. And Bert learns to, I think, embrace it and accept it. But she does resent it as well.
Yeah. So at the quarry where they're not supposed to be on the day that Pansy goes missing, Bert sees a strange friend of her brother Willett's who points to the sky without talking to her. What can you tell us about Bubba Speck?
Well, Bubba was a friend of the family. He was a friend of Willett's, really. And he's one of those kids that I think exists in every community. Actually, lots of these kids exist. He's a little bit strange. He believes odd things. And he's kind of misunderstood. You know, people are quick to actually point the finger at him for the disappearance of Pansy, even though there's really no evidence that he would have had anything to do with it. But he was there in proximity sometimes. Proximity is sometimes enough to take on blame. And so Bubba's a little bit strange, and he believes strange things. And because of this, I think people don't trust him. People are a little suspicious of him. And I'm kind of fascinated by people who believe in, and I like to explore this as well, people who are either superstitious or they believe in magic, or they believe in Bubba's case, alien visitations, are any number of things that we consider a little bit outside mainstream belief. There are actually, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of people out there who believe these things too. And many for good reason. Many feel like they have evidence that these things are happening, whether it's hauntings, which I also deal with in my book a little bit, or whether it's the idea of alien abductions or, you know, curses and myths. And so Bubba was just another side of that coin that I felt like I wanted to explore. And he also was someone that at one point in the book that Bert could turn to as another person who shared this experience, but has a very different memory of it.
Mm-hmm. The quarry itself is almost like a character. The geography of it, the location of it, and everything that happened there. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I really am. I'm always working to make the places in my work, whether it's, you know, a novel or a shorter piece, characters. I think I'm fascinated by the idea of how, you know, a person who is raised in Jackson, Mississippi, as I was raised in Jackson, Mississippi, will not come to the world in the same way that a person who was raised in New York City will come to the world. I mean, we could be the same age, we could be the same basic social economic bracket, and we could be the same political affiliation, all of that. And yet, if I were to meet a woman who was practically my twin, who'd been raised in a completely different place, you know, we would be changed by that in a really dramatic and important way. And I like to explore that in books, even when that's not the core thing I'm exploring. And so I'm always thinking about the way that a particular place can press itself against the characters and actually influence the characters, actually push against the characters. And I think the quarry does that. I mean, the characters go and they sort of trespass into this dangerous place, this place they've been warned against. I mean, their father tells them, you should not swim in the quarry. It's the devil's place. It's cursed. Bad things happen there. And he has good reason. You know, his experience tells him this. He has good reason to warn his children away from the quarry. But kids being kids, you know, there's nothing better than the forbidden, and they're hot, and it's a place that they can swim. So, you know, they go despite the warnings, despite all of the admonitions from their father and their parents in general. And so once they do, and then something bad actually does happen, I feel like the quarry haunts them. I feel like they do blame the quarry to some extent for what happened, and themselves for disobeying their father and for not paying attention to his warnings.
Mm-hmm. I love Granny Clem, who is mm-hmm. famous for dealing with pregnant women and girls, and famous mm-hmm. for her lemon pound cake. Wish the recipe had been in the back of the book.
Well, maybe in the paperback, we'll see. I love to cook and bake myself, and so I write about food a lot. I mean, I think when I'm writing about people having meals or cooking, that's often based on my personal experience. And a lot of the women that I grew up with actually had specialties. My grandmother was known for her coconut cake, well known, like throughout the state, we thought, and maybe that was true. And so a lot of the women I grew up with had a special confection that they would make and that they were known for. And I wanted to give that to Granny Clem. And I don't know how I settled on the lemon pound cake necessarily, except that it's probably what I wanted that day to eat. And it sounded good for summer. So, you know, I did give her that, but I also think I like I said, I love to cook myself. I actually worked as a baker for a brief period of time, and I love to bake. I love getting my hands in the dough. I love mixing up batters, and you know, it's really a great pleasure for me. And I do think that, you know, the process of preparing a cake or a big meal or something like that for a person is a healing act. I mean, it's an act of love. It's an act of healing. It's an act that says, you know, you are valued and you matter to me. And so a lot of what Granny Clem does is about that. And it's not just, you know, she makes those lemon pound cakes, of course, but she also is a healer in a way. And so she grows healing herbs and she uses those herbs and her own self-taught medical training, as you said, to deliver babies, sometimes to end a pregnancy. She's built up kind of like Earl, kind of like the father, Bert's father. She has also built an outside the mainstream career for herself. She makes a living doing things that aren't 100% legal all the time, but she lives in a place, as many people do, where medical care, particularly medical care for women, is sparse. You have to drive a long way to have some of these services provided for you. And if you're a particular sort of woman, you may not even have those options. And so Granny Clem feels what I feels a really particular need in this community. And I wanted her to be, I know she was, you know, she's doing some things that are a little bit, like I said, not 100% legal. And some people might consider some of her actions to not be 100% moral, but I really wanted her to be the sort of character you would love enough to forgive any transgressions. I love her too.
I loved her too. I want Grandma like that. She, you tell the story within the story, within another story of when she was young. Her, Granny Clem was young Clementine, and she had a best friend named Aura. And I was very moved by the story of the woman who was raped by one of the German prisoners in 1944. Mm-hmm. So how did you come up with a camp that German prisoners in Mississippi? How did you come up with that?
That is based on an actual story. There were German prisoner of war camps in Mississippi. There were several. And the German prisoners were put into service to chop cotton and that sort of thing. So that part of it was based on history. The woman who running away and, you know, actually being raped by the soldier, that was my imagination. But there was a woman in the Delta who was the wife of a fairly prominent man who did, in fact, run off with one of the German soldiers. So that was the germ of the idea for the story for me. It became a completely different story in my writing of it, but that's where I started.
I love the part where Bert starts working for Granny Clem at learning about midwifery and herbs. That was a wonderful continuation. So is
Thank
Bert
you.
Going to take over?
You know, I don't know if Bert will actually take over. I think that Bert will not lose the knowledge, will never lose the knowledge that she gained working for Granny Clem. And I think that she is I think that the things she learned will continue to serve her, whether she chooses to live the same life Granny Clem does. I don't know so much about that. That goes beyond the imagination of the book, I think. But I do think that everything, and Bert does use what she's learned actually later in the book to some extent. Mm-hmm. And I think that everything she has learned will continue to inform what she does. I can't imagine that Bert's going to run off and get into a profession that isn't helping people. I do think she'll help in some way.
We haven't talked about Loretta, Willett, Bert, and Pam's mother, mm-hmm. Earl's wife.
Right.
So Loretta also comes with a story.
Yes. And Loretta, you know, a lot of these characters who, particularly of Loretta's generation, were in some way orphaned and ended up, because at some point, Granny Clem and Aura, her friend, were taking in orphans basically. And so Loretta, I think, is she's an interesting character because when we first meet her, she's just an ordinary mom. I mean, she's cooking dinner for her kids. She basically chases them out of the house and says, "Go away, because you're driving me crazy," as, you know, moms do. And then, of course, by the time they come back at the end of that day at the quarry, everything has changed. And her youngest, her favorite, is missing. And so she changes very dramatically, very quickly, from a woman who is an ordinary mother doing the best she can with a man who is not around very much, which I think is not an unusual story in this country or probably any country, a man who is not around very much with very little help. And she has pulled herself up through a very difficult upbringing, her own self. She lost her parents in a violent way and her, you know, was kind of taken in by this family and ended up finding her husband. But she loves her husband, even though he's not there a lot. I mean, I wanted that to be clear. This wasn't some marriage of convenience or because they didn't have any other choices. You know, she loved him. So she goes from being really an ordinary wife and mother to being a person who feels like she has lost everything very, very quickly over the course of the book. And it does destroy her. It takes her down.
This is really the bottom line, it's a coming of age story for Bert. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes.
And
yeah,
one of the first early things that she does to gain independence that she desperately needs is going to see Bubba after she hears him talking on the radio.
Right.
Interesting scene.
Yeah. Well, so I don't know if you have ever stayed up very, very late and listened to AM radio, but there are all these shows on late at night where people do talk about their alien abductions or their encounters with past life or with ghosts or that kind of thing. I was not particularly familiar with this world until, for some unknown reason, my mother mentioned that she had listened to some of these radio shows. And she's not, my mother is the most practical, down-to-earth woman you could ever imagine. And then my husband, we were going somewhere, just driving across Colorado, and it was late, and he had dialed them in as well. And they really are fascinating programs where people call in and share these stories. And there's this sense that the people who are calling in, like, this is their only lifeline to someone who's going to believe them, because they are not believed about what they're saying in every other facet of their life. But come, you know, midnight, there's some guy on the other end of the line who will listen to you and who will believe you and who will share your story, not just with him, but with all of his listeners. And so once I settled on Bubba's kind of obsession with the supernatural or with the extraterrestrial, I just thought it would be the perfect job for him, frankly. And so I gave him that radio show and had people call in. And of course, when Bert hears it, her first thought is, here is someone else who shared this experience that won't leave me year after year after year, and that I would like to solve. And I am going to go find him. And she does. And I really like the idea of someone listening to the radio, recognizing a voice, and then getting in their car and going.
Even if the callers are talking about how they were abducted by aliens and returned.
Sure. I mean, maybe it's not the wisest. Right. Maybe it's not the wisest thing to just go running off to talk to someone who is ultimately a stranger by this point. But, you know, Bert's been on her own for a long time now. Nobody's raising her really at this point. She's, you know, she's raised herself. And like you said, it is a coming of age story. It is Bert discovering who she is and who her family is, why she is who she is. And I think this was one part of that discovery. You know, she's chasing down what people believe, and she finds that Bubba maybe believes something completely different than everyone else. And I think that Bert would chase any belief if it had to do with the disappearance of her sister and her father at that point.
And the other thing that helps her move towards adulthood is after the 1980, they find a decomposed body in an Everglades motel. And there's some speculation that it could be Earl, her father. Mm-hmm. And now she goes on a journey.
Right. So, she and Willett, after this body is found and they are told that it is her father, so they wonder why would our father be in the Florida Everglades? And at that point, there's nothing holding them to the Mississippi Delta anymore. And Bert is really kind of nervous to leave. She's never left. She's never traveled. She's young. You know, all of this stuff happened when she was quite young. And so she's never really traveled much outside this small, tiny sphere that she lives in. But Willett, in the intervening years, has actually been supporting the family, and he has been out working on construction crews. And so he has traveled a little bit more extensively. And he's the one who originally says, then we need to go to Florida. We need to go to the Everglades. We need to find out what he was doing there, because I think they both still believe really that what makes the most sense is that their father took their sister. They've both been gone this whole time, and they're still sort of chasing that possibility. So when that body turns up, they go.
And now they're in Florida, and it turns out that mm-hmm. Willett has stolen some pictures from Granny Clem.
Right. So Willett does not trust Granny Clem quite in the same way that Bert always has. He doesn't have quite the same close relationship with her. And he has always believed that Granny Clem might know a little more than she's letting on about his sister's disappearance, about his father's disappearance. And so he's been snooping, and he has taken some old photographs and also a few other little, I like to think of them as totems, that he feels like might help them locate their father, you know, locate someone who has known their father, or locate someone who might know where Pansy is. And they are actually showing these pictures around the Florida Everglades to see if anyone will recognize them, even though the pictures are of his father as a young, you know, as a boy.
Is your portrayal of the Everglades as this very insider, outsider, not very friendly, everybody is very cautious. Is that based on anything, or did you invent that? Is that really how the Everglades are?
Well, I won't say that people aren't friendly, because they are. My husband and I actually went to the Everglades when I had decided that this particular story was going to go there. I've spent a good deal of time in Florida and a little bit in the Everglades, but not a ton. But when I was writing the book, I said, if I'm going to write scenes here, I have to go. And we did. And we went kayaking, and we went on a boat trip, and we saw the 10,000 islands. And so a lot of the things I write about were really based on that one particular trip. And the people were friendly. But there is a guardedness, I would say. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that in the 1980s, there were multiple sweeping federal drug busts in the Everglades, because it was the place where most of the marijuana was coming in from Colombia. And so there was this huge trade that was happening there at the time, where the fishermen and the fishermen had been, that's how people made their living mostly, was going out and fishing, and they would send that fish out all over America. But the fishermen had been curtailed quite a bit by all of these new sort of federal laws that came in and said, no, this is a protected area. You can no longer fish it, or you can only fish it from, you know, for these 3 days this month. I mean, there were some very harsh restrictions being put on people's livelihood. And in order to make up the difference, they started fishing basically for bales of marijuana out in the Florida Everglades. And so those events play a role in the book, though mine is fictionalized. But because of that, a huge portion of their adult male population was actually arrested in the 1980s. And so they had reason to become mistrustful. And there's, before that, you know, even before the marijuana trade, there was smuggling of people. There was smuggling of rum. It's a port. It's a port where things come in that are not necessarily welcomed, or they're not welcomed by the law. And so there is some reason for them to be mistrustful. And it's pretty isolated. I mean, you have to want to go there. You're not going to stumble upon it.
Well, I found it very satisfying how you led to those concluding chapters, and how Willett found his niche and Bert found what she was looking for. It was really well done. So kudos to you.
Thank you.
And I've taken up so much of your time already. I'd like to ask you the traditional closing new books question. What's next for you? Yeah. What are you working on?
Well, I am working on a new book. It's still in the very early stages. And so at that point, I don't like to talk too much about what, like the plot or what it's about so much. But I am working on something that is set in Jackson, Mississippi, which is the place in Mississippi where I spent most of my time as a child and young adult, where I was raised. And I'm actually kind of playing with the idea of setting it on the street where I grew up. I have such strong memories, of course, I think as everyone does, but I lived in the house where I grew up from birth till the time I left for college. We never moved. You know, it was actually a great house. It was a great neighborhood. And so I'm kind of exploring the idea of setting it in that neighborhood, but in a very different time period. And so that's what I'm working with right now. I'm still in the very early stages, but I'm also working on some shorter stuff, and hopefully some of that will come out before I can get a new novel out.
I hope you'll let me know when your new novel comes out. Thank you so much for sharing your time with me, Tiffany. It has been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Galit. It's been great to talk to you.
And thank you for listening to this podcast from the New Books Network. Once again, I'm G.P. Gottlieb, host of New Books in Literature, and today I've been talking with Tiffany Quay Tyson about her novel, The Past Is Never. Join the New Books Network and learn both about my upcoming podcasts and those of other hosts in a variety of categories. Goodbye until my next conversation for the New Books Network.